Because this book of Samuel, again, in the Christian Bible, we have 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, but it's just one book in the Hebrew Bible. This book of Samuel is where the story of David and Goliath comes from. And so we want to bear in mind the sort of context in which we're reading this story. And again, last week, we talked a little bit about, okay, so what is the theological perspective? What are the overarching themes of the Deuteronomistic history? And we maybe we could go to the next slide, Greg. We put up a much bigger slide than this, but I've narrowed it down a little bit so it would fit more coherently onto one slide. But we had 6 points last week, but I just want to mention three this week. We mentioned them all last week. We're going to reiterate them today. The theology of the Deuteronomistic history is the issue of covenant. In other words, God is not some sort of a being who can be persuaded or manipulated, or, you know, if you offer the right sacrifices and do the right things, God will send the rains and give you blessings. But rather, the relationship with God is based on covenant. It's a commitment, a relational commitment from God. And that commitment says you'll have land, you'll have people, you know, a nation, and you'll have blessing, prosperity. Another theme is the theme of theocracy. That kind of sounds scary to us. I personally would not want to live in a theocracy, right? Because they don't really exist. They're really, you know, they're not cultures ruled by God. They're cultures ruled by human beings who claim to speak for God, right? So this is a slightly different thing. But the view of the Deuteronomist is that we should be led by God, or the people of Israel should be led by God, not by human leaders, not by a monarchy or a leadership structure based on monarchy. And that's a bit of a problem because, you know, the people are meant to be following the law, following this way, following this sort of shalom life, but they stray from it. And it's the prophets who call them back to the law. That's the role of the prophet, to call people back to the way of God. But the people eventually want the king, right? And so actually a king is made, and King Saul is the first king. And it's very clear in this history that it's narrated that God says the people have rejected me. The fact they want a king is equivalent to them rejecting me. That's how it's narrated. Now, let's remember, whenever we read scripture, when it says God says, what we're hearing there or reading there is what people say God says. Right, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean exactly that. We've got to be careful about that. But that's how it's narrated, that it's a rejection of God because they want a king like the other nations have, and they want to trust in human leadership and a human structure. And then the third big issue here is that the whole point of the law, or one of the main points of the law, is this issue of social justice. Now, that's not some politically correct thing. We hear a lot about social justice, don't we? And for some people, it resonates. And for some people, it's like, I'm a bit skeptical about that. What does that really mean? Well, what this is about is living a loving life, a life where everyone's included, where it's fair, where there's rules in place to prevent the overaccumulation of wealth within the hands of a few, and the periodic distribution of wealth so everybody has a chance, so everybody is treated equally. And there's laws in the Deuteronomic history that are emphasized that are all about loving your neighbors, loving outsiders, foreigners, people who aren't part of your family or part of your nation even, and especially caring for the poor. And we saw last week how the poor are kind of epitomized by the term widows and orphans. So people who perhaps have been cut off from economic prosperity, that they should be looked after. And the job of the kings, the job of leadership, is to look after the poor. So we'll just keep that up there for a moment. So there are three of the main themes of the you can tell I'm having trouble saying that word, Deuteronomistic history. If you can say it, that's perhaps the beginning of understanding. Okay, so there's just three things. There's more, but there's just three. Now, when we think about these stories in the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, a story like David and Goliath, you've got to ask ourselves, why did they write these stories? Why did they write these stories down? And another question would be, how did they write these stories? Where do these stories come from? How is it all put together? So let's think about the why first, because if we can look at why and look at how, it will give us a bit of a clue, I think, into interpretation of the stories, including the story of David and Goliath. So why did they write these stories? Well, the main reason, it seems, is to explain why this thing didn't really work out. Because On the one hand, you've got this promise. God saying, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to bless you. You're going to, nations are going to become great, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of promise we looked at a couple of weeks ago to Abraham. But then the history of the Hebrew people is calamity. It failed as a nation state. And we have sort of key dates there. Sometime early in the 10th century, you've got to ask the question, why did they elect a monarch? Or not even elect, but why was a monarch appointed when they're supposed to be in covenant with this issue with God? What? So we've got to explain that somehow. Secondly, around about 930 BCE, the kingdom divides. There's a civil war. It divides. You have Israel in the north, Judah in the south. So that doesn't sound, that wasn't supposed to happen, surely. Gets even worse. In 722 BCE, the northern kingdom is overrun by the Assyrian Empire and the country is just destroyed. And not only that, they invade Judah in the south and get right up to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem only just manages to resist. But then eventually in 586 BCE is defeated and destroyed and the temple destroyed by the Babylonian Empire and they're all carried off into exile. So it seems that the Hebrew people at various points in that history were looking back and trying to explain how did all this happen. And you can imagine, especially if you're in exile in Babylon and you're thinking about, we're supposed to have this covenant, God is supposed to be on our side, you would be asking those questions. And these stories were written to try and explain what happened. We'll talk about how they were written in a second, or probably, I mean, I don't know for sure, but just based on research and scholarship, how they were probably written. But the issue here is, the theme is then that, okay, why did this not seem to work out? And the response of the historians here is that it was because of, not that God had let people down, but because the people were disobedient to God. So we have, you know, they didn't live this life out here. They didn't live the law. They weren't obedient. In particular, they were disobedient around the issues of social justice. They had a monarchy where power was corrupting and the kingships became corrupt and abusive. We talked a little bit about that last week. And the poor suffered. The poor weren't cared for. And the whole definition of worship of Yahweh, based on these historians' view, is not about getting all the right sacrifices, the right practices, but loving people and caring for people and having a just society. So that's why you have prophets like Amos saying things like this in the next slide. Think of the language here. I despise your religious festivals. Your assemblies are a stench to me. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. So that's what this God, Yahweh, is looking for. This is Amos writing in the 8th century and prophesying to the northern kingdom of Israel. Well, in around about the same time in the south, you have Micah, who says something very similar. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil, olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. So here's the response to that question. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. So this is the essence of the Hebrew spirituality, but they strayed from that due to corrupt leadership and neglect of the poor. And so the theme of the Deuteronomists is it wasn't God's fault, right? That's what they say. Okay, it's not God that let people down. We let God down. We let people down. And the issue here is the covenant, the determining factor of the covenant is if you're obedient to the covenant, then you will be blessed. And if you're disobedient, then calamity will happen. You won't be blessed. And there's something reassuring, perhaps, something even potentially beautiful about that, right? Because we all want to think how we live matters. It seems right that we would be responsible for our actions. There's something karmic about it, if you like. The early church leader would say, you reap what you sow. Right, there's something that seems right about that, but there's also a problem with that. Two problems, perhaps. One, and I think we need to bear these in mind as we interpret these stories. One is that that could itself lead to another kind of superstitious religious practice, right? Where it's like, okay, so if we do the right things, God blesses us. So let's make sure we do the right things. And you end up a little bit like the Pharisees, perhaps, in the Christian scriptures, where it's like, dot your I's, cross your T's. That's the essence of spirituality. And of course, Jesus comes along and blows that out of the water. Says, oh, that's missing the point. So even in the point, we can end up missing the point. And the second challenge is, if it's true that if you're good, God will bless you, and if you're bad, God won't bless you, then the reverse of that is if you're suffering or struggling, or if you're poor, or if you're not particularly successful in life, it must mean you're a bad person. And there seems something wrong about that. And in fact, in the third section of scripture that I was talking about earlier, the Ketuvim or the writings, there are some books like Job, for instance, and Ecclesiastes would be another one, where that premise is challenged, where the premise that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people, that premise is challenged. So it's kind of true and it's not true at the same time. There's some tension there. And this is what we have in scripture. We have different voices and different perspectives to try and help us hold certain tensions that are just obvious about the reality of life. And we can't just land on one and become sort of absolute about it without addressing the other one. And Jesus, of course, addressed this. This is what's so revolutionary about Jesus. Jesus comes along and said, you've heard it said, and he quotes the law, like, love your enemy, and then there was a little addendum, love your neighbor, and a little addendum, hate your enemy. And he says, but I say, love your neighbors and love your enemies. And so Jesus reinterprets the law to bring us back, not to the letter of the law, but to the spirit of the law, or the spirit of this way of God, if you like. And then secondly, Jesus, of course, says, he totally reverses and turns upside down this issue of, if you're struggling, you must have done something wrong. He does that multiple times, perhaps most classically in the Beatitudes, right? In Matthew 5, we'll just read a few of these. Blessed are the poor in spirit. In Luke's version, it says, blessed are the poor, just not even in spirit, just blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. So we have Jesus saying, look, it's not about, don't be fooled. Just because somebody's rich and wealthy and powerful, that doesn't make them good. They may have got that through all kinds of corrupt means. Likewise, just because you're struggling and suffering doesn't mean you're bad. Actually, you might be closer to God in that moment. And we saw last week with the story of the widow of Zarephath, and in multiple stories through the Hebrew scriptures, that God seems to be with the outsiders, with the lowly, with the poor, with the vulnerable, with the perceivably weak, rather than with powerful elites. And that was totally different to all the other religions of the day. So what we have in these stories is the clash of those worldviews, the clash of good against evil, if you like. And these stories are told in very fantastical, almost mythological ways, where there's a lot of bloodshed, right? There's a lot of fighting and warfare going on, which I think we could see as being a metaphorical explanation of the battle of good and evil, if you like, of the battle of the way of God against this more power elite way, this way of selfishness, this way of control. And that's what I think we have going on in this story of David and Goliath. Now, finally, just as context, and then we'll get into the story briefly. How did they write these stories? We have to ask ourselves how. So that's why. So we've got to be careful about the why. But then how did they write these stories? And not just David and Goliath, but all these stories. And it would seem that they're drawing on, because the Hebrews did not sit down and write systematic theology. Like you can buy a systematic theology book online, explain where somebody says, here's the reality about God. I mean, that's their perspective. The Hebrews didn't write like that. Nor did they write, as we talked about last week, objective history in the way that we would think of history. But they wrote stories. That's what the ancients did. They told stories and they wrote stories. And they're probably drawing on oral traditions, well-known stories. They're probably drawing on maybe written down stories. So if you read the Book of Kings, for instance, it frequently says, and you can read more about this king in the annals of the kings of Israel, or the annals of the kings of Judah, or the annals of the annals of King David. So there were other books, it seems, or scrolls that had some of the details about these kings. And you wonder if these authors, these editors in the Deuteronomistic tradition, are drawing on these stories and then retelling them in such a way as to make a theological point, to make an existential point, to make a moral point. And they're retelling these stories. So when we read the stories, they don't feel like the story of David and Goliath, you know, a small person defeating a giant, has a sort of folkloric feel about it, doesn't it? And that's probably because it's told that way. It's not necessarily meant to be interpreted literally. Because if we start interpreting it literally, then there's a heck of a lot of people getting killed and punished. And we might be convinced that that's the way of God and that's what we should be doing. But if we view this more as a story that's told for a certain reason, we can actually glean that truth and then start thinking about, okay, so how does this impact my life? And so when we read these stories, we read conflicting views. We read different traditions, you know, repetitions where the story is retold a different way. And it's presumably these editors drawing on material, some of which doesn't necessarily agree with itself, and still presenting it there as evidence of God at work in the story of the Hebrew people. And when we come, as we now will, to the story of David and Goliath, we see all of that. So, for instance, we're going to look at the story in 1 Samuel 17. It's a kind of long section, so we're just going to pick off different pieces. But when we look at the chapter before it, we get two origin stories for David. So David is this new king. Saul, the first king, doesn't have any kids, eventually doesn't have kids that are alive. So there's a new king, and there's a story of why David is the new king. And in chapter 16, we get Samuel being called by God. Samuel's the prophet. He says, go to this family, and I'm going to show you who to anoint to become the next king. You may be familiar with that story. And it's the youngest. It's the youngest of all the kids. Not who you'd expect it to be, which is typical. Again, it's the small people. God is with the small people, with the young rather than the youngest rather than the oldest, the less rather than the more. So, and we get in the next scripture here, the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him," which is kind of a reference to Saul, because Saul was this big guy. He was head and shoulders above everybody else. But this new king is not like that. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So there's an origin story for David, which is about, oh, he's the youngest. He's going to be a different kind of king. Then we get another origin story right after it, still in chapter 16, where Saul, the king, he's kind of going crazy, and David's this musician who comes and plays for him to sort of calm him down. And you get this sort of impression that, okay, David is this artistic, creative guy who's close to the heart of God, and Saul's this tormented individual. So there's another origin story, and those two stories don't really communicate with each other. They're almost separate stories side by side. And then you get a third origin story, which is the Goliath story. So here's this shepherd kid that appears on the scene when the Israelites are fighting the Philistines, and this giant is coming out and tormenting them. And this shepherd boy comes out and defeats the giant. And at the end of the story, Saul says, "Who's that guy? Whose son is he?" He doesn't even know who he is, it appears, when we've just had one story right before it where he's the harpist for Saul. So we have three origin stories which suggest three different traditions, and the writers saw fit to put all those in there because they tell different things about David and different aspects of David's life. We also have in these stories conflicting opinions. So here is an origin story about David, which is kings are good. Finally, we've got a good king. So there's a pro-monarchy story. But then later we have another famous story about David that we've probably all heard of, David and Bathsheba, where David rapes Bathsheba. Certainly there's no consent involved or recorded in the relationship. And he's become the abusive monarch. He's power has corrupted him. So there's a sort of positive story about David, or positive stories, and there's negative stories about David, and they're all included. I think we should read into that we're meant to wrestle with these scriptures and look at the tensions, live within those tensions, and work things out for ourselves about what we think they mean and what they say, rather than taking them literally and say, this means this, and that means that, and that's the end of it. So we're wrestling with literature, we're wrestling with brilliant storytelling. And David and Goliath is perhaps one of the best examples of that. Okay, let's jump into the text. Beginning of Samuel, 1 Samuel 17. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damin between Socah and Issachar. We're all familiar. Everybody sort of got their bearings, right? Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. Okay, so what we have here, we don't know, right? Don't worry, we haven't got our bearings. So let's look at a couple of maps. Here's a map we've been looking at with of the ancient Near East. Here's the Eastern Mediterranean. We're talking about this region, right? Canaan here. So let's look at the next map, home in a little bit. This is the United Kingdom of Israel. This is before the kingdom was divided. And you can see here, so here's Israel. And then there's Philistine down there. It's pretty much the equivalent of the Gaza Strip today. And the Philistines had kind of become the arch enemy of the Hebrew people. So, you know, if we could almost see the Philistines as metaphorically representing everything that's against Yahweh, everything that's against the way of the Israelite people. And then if we home in a little more, we'll see some of these next map. We'll see a little bit more detail about Philistia. And so it's around about this region here that this battle is going on. Now, this is the dotted line is believed to be the territory of the Philistines. We don't know exactly for sure, because they weren't really a nation state. They were a confederation of big cities. But it could be that Israel is in the sort of territory of the Philistines. And that, you know, again, if we take that literally, that makes Israel the oppressor, right, or the aggressor. But that's not the point of the story here. We're just got it located in the Valley of Elah, which is a wadi, you know, it's a ravine that's been made by water. And in that ravine, this hill to either side, it's obviously must be the dry season, because, you know, Goliath goes down into the ravine, we'll see in a second. And we've got two armies on either side. Nobody wants to go into the valley, right? You're in a strategic position up on the hills. Let's look at the next section. And we're not going to read the whole story, but, you know, a fair bit of it. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. Okay, so that's about 3 meters, close to 10 feet. Some manuscripts have him 6'9", which is a little bit more realistic, perhaps. You know, so this is sort of perhaps a little bit of embellishment, but this is a big guy. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels, and on his legs he wore bronze greaves. A bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. That's about 15 pounds. So his armor weighs about 150 pounds, and this tip of his spear is 15 pounds. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." A lot of bravado. On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. So here we have Goliath, this giant. He's massive. We don't really know. I mean, maybe he really is 10 foot tall. We don't. But he's huge. He's covered in armor, and the armor is really heavy. The writer goes to great lengths to describe the armor, and, you know, helmet, and he's got a armor on his body, and then an armor on his legs. The author is also telling us something, right? That his face is vulnerable. So it was a little bit of a setup. And he comes out, and he's full of bravado, and that's in direct contrast to King Saul and all the others, because they're intimidated, they're afraid. Even though Saul was supposed to be this mighty warrior and was head and shoulders above the rest, as the scripture would describe him, this is kingship in decline. This is monarchy in decline. He's just afraid, and he's paralyzed and he's sat in the camp. They just don't know what to do. Now, David is a shepherd boy and his brothers are at the battle. So his father sends him with some food to go and give to his brothers. And here's what happens next. Now, the Israelites have been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel, and he came out for 40 days in a row, which again feels kind of symbolic, right? 40 is just a great number in Hebrew scriptures. He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give a great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel. Well, I'll certainly take the taxes, being exempt from the taxes there. But David asked the men standing near him, what will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? They repeated to him what they've been saying and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. So we know what's going to be done. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Now what have I done? Said David. Can't I even speak? So we have a classic brother bust up here, right? It's like, what have I done now? The younger brother, you know, he's always the one in trouble, it seems like. But you have this classic older brother, younger brother thing. So it's like in Hebrew, the Hebrew stories, it's always the younger one who should be the inferior based on inheritance and that kind of thing, who is the one who's elevated. And the older one, like take Jacob and Esau, for instance, would be a great example of that. So here again, we're getting this. David is portrayed, he's a shepherd boy, he's not even at the army, he's young, his brother is putting him down, which is, you know, a bit rich given that his brother's sat there quaking on the sidelines and, you know, he's as afraid as anybody else. And David's kind of he's not worried about this. So we've been told David's young, small, not that significant in some ways, but he's not afraid, he has confidence. And we've been told something different about this king that's going to emerge. Let's move on in the story, because Saul hears about and he says, hey, you know, come, let's have a chat. And David says, yeah, you know, I used to kill lions and bears when I'm out there shepherding, and I could take this guy down easily. So Saul's like, I don't think so. But eventually he's persuaded. So he goes, okay, go out there and have a go. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. So what we're getting here is David's trying to be Saul, or Saul's trying to make David like Saul. But what happens? I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream. Okay, again, this is a wadi, so there would have been a stream in the valley in the rainy season. So the nice smooth stones. Incidentally, the stones were probably about the size of a tennis ball, right? I used to think as a kid, little pebbles sort of stuck in Goliath's forehead. But no, we're talking about a rock the size of a tennis ball moving at ballistic speeds. You know, it's going to cause some damage. And they found stones like that, you know, archaeologists have from that era. So he chooses 5 smooth stones, nice and aerodynamic, put them in his pouch of his shepherd's bag. And with his sling in his hand, he approached the Philistine. So here he goes. He's not going to project some kind of macho image. He's not like, oh, I've got to have my armor on. He's not playing Goliath at Goliath's game. Like Goliath's all about bravado, all about armor, all about power. But actually at the same time, Goliath is a bit of a sitting duck here, right? Because he's just lumbering and he's big, and David is small and nimble, and he can strike from a distance with a sling. Let's see how the story plays out, because you've never heard this story, right? It's a really exciting ending. I won't give it away yet. So meanwhile, David goes off down into the valley, right? So meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him and that might be significant. Let's just come back to that in a minute. He kept coming closer to David. So he's coming closer. And then he looked David over and saw he was a little more than a boy. So he didn't seem to get that at first. He has to get closer to see that he's a little boy, glowing with health and handsome. And he despised him. Great language, this. And he said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? Because he's got his staff, you know, doesn't seem to notice the slang. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. Even more bravado. So what we have is, so the shield bearer is leading Goliath out, it seems, or he goes ahead of him. And Goliath doesn't seem to get certain things until he gets a bit closer to David. Sounds like Goliath can't see very well. And one theory here, this is just pure projection, right? So, you know, just bear with me for this. But it could be like, he's a giant, right? He could have a condition called acromegaly, right? You may be familiar with it. It's where the pituitary gland, a gland that secretes hormones, growth hormone in the brain, becomes overgrown and produces too much growth hormone, turns you into a giant. Right? And you have a certain physical characteristics. It can also affect your optic neurology and mean you can have difficulty seeing. Let's just put it like that. It's complicated how it all happens. And it may be that this guy can't even see properly. He's just super intimidating. But actually, he's very vulnerable. And he's been led out by his shield bearer because he has to sort of get closer. And he can't really tell what's going on until he gets closer to David. And he says, come here, because he wants David to come closer to him. Because he knows that if it's sort of arm-to-arm kind of struggle, then he's gonna beat David. But David is wily and tricky. And this is another theme in the Hebrew scriptures of like leaders who, like we heard about Abraham, right, 2 weeks ago. He sort of plays tricks on people. Jacob plays tricks on people. And it's not exactly frowned on in the scriptures. It's like there's some creative imagination going on here. Let's see how it plays out. Here's what David says to the Philistine. You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. So we've already got some metaphorical sense here, right? It's not about weapons. It's about something bigger than this. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals. We shouldn't really take this literally. And the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. Again, sort of metaphorical sense here. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. So again, we've got this sense of like, there's another meaning here. There's another plane. The battle is the Lord's. This is the battle of good against evil. This is the battle of justice against injustice. It's two systems colliding. It's a war that's being described to us in very military graphic terms. So David is not the least bit afraid, right? He's not the least bit afraid. Let's move on. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. He's quick. He's fast. Reaching into his bag. So he reaches. Now, he's got a staff. He's got a sling. So he's got his hands full. But it seems almost like he's feigning. He's reaching into his bag. And perhaps Goliath thinks he's going for his staff or, you know, something more traditional. It doesn't seem like Goliath's worked out he's got a sling at this point. But anyway, he takes out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. So David, and this statement here, I think, let's think of this. This sounds almost like a saying. This sounds like a tradition. Sounds like it could have been an oral tradition. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. I mean, you could almost imagine young Hebrew children recounting that, right? Because it's a well-known refrain about David. We won't look at it, but in the subsequent verses, actually, it goes back to saying that David goes over and kills him by cutting off his head with Goliath's own sword. So that's caused scholars to debate, well, did he die without a sword or not? You know, that's not the point. It's not, we're not meant to pick apart all these details, but look at, okay, something incredible happened here. King David seems to be a different kind of king. He's going to become a different kind of king. And his action, his heroism, his courage inspires all the other Israelites, and they rout the Philistine army. Okay, so as always, we have discussion questions and reflections for this week. So I've just sort of touched on a few aspects of that story, but we'll all get an opportunity to engage with the whole story, the whole chapter, in the discussion questions. I really encourage you to take advantage of those. And so wrestle with it and make your own mind about what you feel it means and what the challenges to you are. But I just want to pick on three things that I think this story challenges in me, at least. And perhaps some of us might be able to identify this. Okay, this is a story about faith that faces the giants of three things, in my view. Injustice, right? What's interesting here is David doesn't fight fire with fire. He doesn't take Goliath on his own terms, but rather he chooses his own strengths. Like he doesn't feel disempowered. He's not intimidated by the giant because he's conscious that there's things he can do. Just like we saw in that opening video clip this morning, if you were here early to watch it. No hands up about who saw it and who didn't. Rather than injustice can be really intimidating. Taking on injustice can be really intimidating. But we look at people throughout history who have refused to be intimidated and have been crafty and wily and clever and smart and courageous and skillful in the way they've gone about it, rather than just being paralyzed in the camp, sat there thinking, how on earth do we do this? So it's an inspiration to us, I think, to stand up and speak out and act for justice. Secondly, perhaps on a more personal level, it's, I think, a challenge about the giants of our fears. I've spent so much time in my life avoiding people I'm afraid of, situations I'm afraid of, avoiding conflict, avoiding situations where I feel I might fail, desperately hoping I don't get things wrong. You think of the list of fears that we all have that can be paralyzing to us and inhibit us from living this full life that God wants us to live and invites us to live. And we're sat there in the camp, and every time one of those things comes out, it's like, oh God, I can't deal with that conflict, or I can't deal with that kind of person, or that kind of situation. And so we avoid it. And that's what I spent many hours of my life avoiding situations. And the problem with avoidance is a pretty good technique up to a point, right? Because you get off the hook. But the trouble is, the more you avoid it, that giant just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And after 40 days, that giant comes out and it's like looking bigger than ever and can never be defeated in our own minds. And the only way to face those giants is to face those giants, right? Where we just face it. And it takes a lot of courage, and it's not easy, but we just have to take a step. Like David goes out into the valley and takes a step towards the giant. And so it may be for us that with this fears that we need to face, and we've been avoiding them for decades, but we can experience healing by facing them. And then thirdly, facing our demons. What I mean by this is there's an irony in this story, I think. It's tragic. It's really tragic in that David had the courage to face Goliath, but he wasn't able to face his own dysfunction. Right? I think there's pretty good evidence, if you read these stories, that David was probably a sex addict. Right? He's not, he's sort of portrayed as this heroic, wonderful kind of person who wrote lovely Psalms and that kind of thing. But he's a pretty unsavory character. I mean, Solomon had to be a sex addict, right? He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Okay, so that's probably an exaggeration. But these guys were out of control. And I'm just picking one issue there. And David was unable, he wreaked havoc through his own dysfunction. So he was courageous in taking on Goliath, but there's a certain irony that he wasn't able to take on the giants in his own life, his own dysfunctions. And he became a corrupt, abusive king. And eventually his kingship declined and ended somewhat disastrously, really. I mean, it provoked the civil war that tore the kingdom apart. So we have to ask ourselves the same questions, like, what are our demons? What are the areas in our lives, the habits, the addictions, the brokenness in our own lives that we're avoiding, that we're probably are aware of it, but we're not prepared to do anything about it because it's just too much. It'll involve too much pain. We have to let go of pride and appearances to acknowledge that we have a problem and to face it, to deal with it. And then that giant just gets bigger and bigger, and it wreaks havoc in our lives. It wreaks havoc in our families. It wreaks havoc in our friendships and relationships. And it doesn't have to be that way. So I'm not, I would say all three of those challenge me. I'm not saying that they are a challenge for you. You might be able to identify with some of them, but do the discussion questions and think about it and wrestle with the story. What does it mean? Because I even as a kid, I grew up in a very conservative religious environment where we took the Bible literally. But even with David and Goliath, the meaning was always metaphorical, right? Nobody ever said to me, you need to go out and find really big people and cut their heads off, or hit them with a sling and then cut their heads off. No, I knew that's not what this story means, right? So the issue is, what does it mean? What does it say about God? What does it say about humanity? What does it say to us now? And I think it's something to do with these kinds of things. That's where we're meant to wrestle with it. So if the band could come up, we'll take communion now. So we have this time pretty much every week where we just have a personal reflection moment, and we involve communion with that, which is this ancient Christian tradition where we remember Jesus, and we remember somebody who was willing to be vulnerable, who redefined what leadership is, who redefined what spirituality is.